Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone. We are coming off a long holiday weekend, and I hope all of you had a great weekend with good tennis weather. I know there are lots of sectional qualifier tournaments going on around the country. I think our Georgia one is just finishing up, and I know I've seen on Facebook and Twitter various coaches and parents posting about their kids' results over the weekend. So I hope everybody had a great experience and reached the goals that they were striving for, whether that was just winning a match or two, or whether it meant qualifying for the sectionals or beating a longtime rival, whatever that may be. And I hope it went well for everybody. It was kind of weird. This is my first year not being at our state qualifier, and I have to say I didn't really miss it. Our state qualifier is kind of brutal. It goes on for days. There are typically at least one or two rain days, and the weather is horribly hot and humid in Macon, Georgia this time of year. So for those of you who were in Macon, I feel your pain and hope you had a great experience. So on today's show, we are really, I'm so lucky to have with us today Kamala Nellen. And Kamala is a former dancer who has turned to yoga and life coaching to help athletes, and specifically elite athletes in a variety of sports, to work on the inner side of their game, the mental side, the emotional side of their game. And she has recently written a new book that was just published that is available to look at on the books page of parentingaces.com. But the name of her book is Working In, and I'm just so excited to have her on the show and to give her the opportunity to share with us what her strategies are for helping young athletes achieve their highest potential. And so without further ado, let me bring Kamala on the line and we'll jump right in. Kamala, thank you again for being with us. I know it's early in your part of the world, on the left coast of the U.S. So I so appreciate you getting up and getting some coffee in you and sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here with you, Lisa.
So you have a dance background, and I haven't really shared this, but I was a dancer in my early years too. Not, I'm sure, anywhere close to the level that you were, but I do have about 15 years of ballet under my belt. So it's an interesting shift to come from a physical art such as dance, and kind of transition into the inner part of being a high-achieving athlete. And I'm so anxious to hear your story and how you got into what you are currently doing. So maybe you can give our listeners a little bit of background on, you know, how you came up through dance and shifted gears in adulthood.
Oh, well, you got an hour now. Let's see. I'll be as brief as I can with this. I started my intensive training around the age of 8 to be a dancer. So I really have a kindred spirit to these athletes coming up. And it was very rigorous, you know, managing a crazy schedule with my training and homework and family duties and things like that. I also didn't have the emotional support from my family that some of these kids are so lucky to have. So for me, coming up in the world of dance, when I got to the professional level, the biggest challenge for me was the mental, emotional side of it, because you don't get support when you're in the majors, so to speak. You're on your own for the most part. So when I finished my career, I met a meditation master. This was way back. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but it completely transformed my life in a way that it's difficult to even express in words. But I embarked on the path of yoga. I immersed myself in it, spent 17 years in an ashram studying and learning all the techniques and practices from the science of yoga. And it really is a lifestyle as well, as you know. So when I got back to teaching outside the ashram and I started teaching, I had so many athletes in classes, and many of them would come to me on the side. And even though I could help them with the physical, I think it's hugely important, as you know, yoga used in the right way or the right situation for an athlete at the right time in their life can be just incredibly powerful on the physical level. But what a lot of these kids at the elite level need is emotional, mental support. And for me, the mental side of yoga is just incredibly powerful and not often used. So I'm really excited to bring that forward. And at the highest level in all sports, it's mental, emotional. So that's in a nutshell how I got into it. And I love helping these kids because, as you know, having been a dancer and a tennis player, you know, we have that heart of an athlete in us. And as parents of tennis players, you probably have that kindred spirit too, if you have the passion to listen to Lisa's program. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And as I shared with you offline, yoga is a big part of my life now and has been for about the past 5 years or so. And as I read your book, I identified very deeply with a lot of the exercises that you explained so well. And there are exercises that I use, you know, and I'm not in any kind of position of having to perform on an elite level or anything. It's just they're exercises that I use to not drive my husband nuts and, you know, try to avoid driving my kids nuts. Not always so successful on the second part. The first part I'm getting better at. But so this is a set of tools that isn't just limited to benefiting elite athletes. I mean, I think it's, you know, one of the things that's so cool about yoga is it can be used by anybody who just wants to increase the quality of their life. And I'm not talking about making more money or, you know, having a better marriage or getting to travel more, but yet I am talking about those things because, you know, when you're balanced from the inside out, good things start to happen for you. And I think, to me, that was my takeaway message from reading your book. And so I just want to ask you, because, and I know I'm babbling here, and I apologize for that, but I'm excited about this, because when I first started reading your book, I thought, okay, well, you know, this is another author telling us, you know, why we need to be doing all these things to improve our mental capacity, but there aren't going to be any really practical tools in there. It's just going to be, here's what you need to do and why. And yet I was so pleasantly surprised to find that you do include some really specific exercises and tools for these athletes to use. And I just want to ask you, what possessed you to sit down and put all of this into book form?
Well, I think it's the athletes. I realized, in a sense, these athletes are fine instruments. They're like Ferraris, you know, but they're treated more as chattel in a way, you know, property, because they're so talented. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more I talk to different athletes, they struggled so much with self-management and finding the anchor inside themselves. I met a tennis player in Laguna Beach when I was interviewing a lot of athletes, when I first realized that's where I really wanted to go with my work, with yoga. And he told me he was incredibly talented. He got on the fast track early on. He was about, I would say 23 when I met him. He had been in rehab for alcohol. He said that's what he used. He couldn't handle the stress of the competitive sports world. And it broke my heart to see that that's the only recourse he had. And so he had to drop out of tennis and get himself back on track. He was performing all over Europe. I mean, he was really on a high-level elite track. I got stories like that or you know, situations where athletes would be fighting, team discord, or incidents with fear and performance, or fear of losing a contract, the terror that, oh, my God, I'm going to get fired because my batting averages aren't up to snuff, or, you know, the women are chasing after these guys in baseball and football and things. And these young kids at the high school age, volleyball players, tennis players, baseball players, they're so out of balance with their lives that they begin to crumble because it's just drive, 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 drive. And although we know that's crucial, there has to be some kind of break, and they have to know how to take care of the body and the brain. So my overriding passion with the book is please let me help them not to turn to the performance supplements, the steroids, the recreational substances, the alcohol, because we know that's the big elephant in the room that destroys careers across the board in sports. So I wrote this book, well, partly because a friend of mine who played with the Jets, an NFL team, said to me, there is a proliferation of physical tools for sports. You know, there's a lot of athletic trainers and performance specialists, but there isn't a lot about the mental stuff. And that makes and breaks an athlete in truth at the top level, because at a certain point, everybody performs, you know, incredibly well. They're trained, their drills are in order. You know this as a tennis player, but what sets the athlete apart, and if I could just share this with parents, and you may have heard this, I've heard college coaches say that when a parent overmanages a child, the college will not consider that child for their team because they want athletes who have self-control and the ability to manage stress and to take failure and to be in a team and be part of a powerful unit. So I thought that was really telling. So I really want them to be empowered. I guess that's the main thing, to find their power.
Right.
And to soften.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're absolutely right, and I've heard the exact same thing from coaches. Excuse me. So, I mean, like you said, there is a proliferation of resources out there for the physical side of a player's training. Why do you feel like the off-court mental side is equally important? Other than, I mean, you just mentioned a couple reasons, but, you know, we see athletes at all ages and stages who are willing to go to the gym and lift weights, who are willing to do footwork drills or, you know, hit against the wall in addition to their regular training, but who aren't necessarily willing to put in the effort on the mental side of the game. And I think, interestingly, with Novak Djokovic being so open about how yoga has helped him, you know, this is starting to get into the media a lot more, and hopefully it's trickling down to the junior aspect of the game, certainly trickling down to college sports. I mean, we hear, you know, all the time about college teams hiring people like you to come in and help the players. But at the junior level, it's still kind of slow to catch on.
Well, I think, Lisa, it really is just lack of knowledge about it. And truth, if you look at the trajectory of an elite athlete's path, at certain ages, they just have to focus on their drills, you know, getting the technique down. So for some of them, and I've noticed, especially with the high school age, their schedules are so packed that would be the main thing that they have to juggle. So they're not always ready to go deeper with the mental stuff unless they're already set apart from the pack. And they're a little bit older. I want to say 15, 16. I don't want to make that a blanket statement because some of these young kids, I mean, I've seen a gymnast who was 10 years old be able to understand what this was about. But more often than not, I think it's really just learning to manage the body and get the drills down, wouldn't you say, at a younger mm-hmm. age. But that being said, if we can help them to learn to turn inward a little bit more, I guess I want to say the most important thing that I've seen is that a young athlete is really influenced by adults and the media and all the hype around sports, but often they don't even know what they want or what they're feeling. If we can help them without trying to control them or push them toward being an elite athlete, I think it really has to come from them. And Carl Mecklenburg is a friend of mine. He played 12 years with the Broncos. You know, his parents never encouraged him or discouraged him. He said he was passionate about football from a very young age, and that's what drove him going forward, and that's what made him able to handle the incredible downs that happen. I mean, the challenges coming up are huge. So I think it behooves us as parents and coaches at a young age to just support them to find themselves, you know, to find what's really important to them inside. And they're like little flowers at that age. You know, you have to, more than anything, give them space to be who they are. And some of these tools, I think, might be too much for them. But to learn the basics of how to get in touch with what they're feeling and what they're wanting and what they're needing is a huge step in the mental training at a young age. I don't know if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Am I making any sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and I mean, I read your book and I went through and highlighted a bunch of stuff. One of the sentences that jumped out at me early on in the book, and I want to just read it so I don't misquote, but you wrote, "You also have to be humble, willing to listen well and follow the instructions of your sports coaches and mentors." And this jumped out at me because in an individual sport such as tennis, being humble is a really tough quality to develop and manage. And I think it's interesting at the professional level. You know, if you look at Serena Williams, I don't think anybody would describe her as humble. I think one of the reasons that people didn't like Novak Djokovic when he first came on the scene is we would never have described him as humble. But I think you use the word humble maybe in a different sense. And
yeah.
I've seen this in my own child. So I'm interested to hear your take on this. But the other part of that sentence that jumped out at me is follow the instructions of your sports coaches and mentors. And so, again, with tennis as an individual sport, the coaches play such an important role in the development of these young athletes. And as parents, we rely on the coaches as well to guide us. So I think it's really important for the coaches to embrace the importance of the mental development of these players as well, and to encourage the players to seek support and help with developing those skills.
Yeah, yes, and I think what I mean by humility is that to remain open-minded. And I think this is a kind of a razor's edge with coaches, because I've talked to kids that say at all levels, at the professional level, at the high school level, and even at junior high level, that the coaches can come on really strong in a way that the child doubts whether they're valued. So it's important to know that the coach is trying to make you a better athlete. But it's also important for the athlete to understand that to be respectful to a coach or a parent is different than giving up my own sense of myself. So, for instance, if a coach is coming on really strong, I worked with a professional baseball player. He was coming up into the majors. He was a minor league player, but he said he thought his coach hated him because he was driving him so hard. And the athlete had a shift in perspective to see that the coach really wanted him to make it to the majors, and his method was maybe not congruent with the athlete's desire to be treated with more respect. And so humility in the sense of trying to get that your coach is really has your back, we hope, you know, we really hope that in all cases that's true, that maybe their way of communicating is not what you would prefer. So humility in trying to understand that the teachers and the coaches are really wanting to help them. Does that make any sense?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I'm glad you clarified that, because it's a tough call. Again, you know, my focus is tennis, but, I mean, this really applies across the board, not just in sports. It applies to anything that our kids are pursuing. Being open to a coach and you know, we often hear from coaches that they're looking for coachability in kids. You know, they don't want to work with kids that aren't coachable. And I think your definition of coachable is humility. I mean, you're kind of using those two words interchangeably is how I'm hearing you, which I think it's important for parents to understand that. And, you know, there's this tendency, I think, for us when our kids aren't being treated the way we think they should be treated to start bad-mouthing the coach. And that just, you know, opens up a whole bad pathway of things.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't want to even bring that up, but I think it's a huge issue. And I really want to have compassion for parents, because I get that college tuition, if I had to put my son through college now, I'd have a fit. He got a scholarship. Thank God he's a professional musician now. But I understand the drive to get these kids scholarships. But at a certain point, we have to allow them to fall down, to fail. Because if they don't know how to fail, then they'll never be winners. You know, I think that's a huge track for parents to... And also to see, I mean, I don't know if you've ever read Andrea Agassi's book, you know, how much
yes.
He hated tennis. He hated it
yeah.
with a passion. To me, that's a crime against a child. And I know he was one of the greatest, but it breaks my heart that this young boy, who I believe what he said, he hated it, yet he
mm-hmm.
had to go forward because of his dad. And one wonders, you know, what the value in that is. Well, now he's got he's running a school in Nevada, in Las Vegas. I don't know. Well, he was
yeah,
anyway.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
But to me, can we as parents, because I went through this with my son as a musician, can we trust that they have the answers inside and they do have the capacity to go through all of this without us carrying them? I think that's the biggest challenge as a parent, wouldn't you agree? To
absolutely.
Trust that your kids, yeah. So,
well, and
yeah.
and as you said, to let them fall down, and
yeah,
you know,
and if the coach is going to yell at him and give him a hard time, and maybe be, I mean, as a dancer, I had this. The whole class stopped. I was at the New York City Ballet School when I was 13. What's wrong with you? She said, here we are on the moon and you can't even execute this. And it was humiliating as all get out for me. But the point
mm-hmm.
is you've got to be able to deal with a challenging coach. Or, you know, if you crumble when somebody looks at you sideways, or you don't make the first string, or you get beat in the first round, if you can't handle that, then you're not going to make it at the top level. You're just not, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, and this is a great segue to the next section that I highlighted. it's perfect, because the next thing I highlighted was you wrote, for you as an elite athlete, self-inquiry is crucial. First, because when it comes to your dream goal, your heartfelt conviction is paramount. More importantly, the purpose of this self-reflection exercise, and you go on to describe an exercise, is for you to ascertain whether the goal you are pursuing is in your heart's desire rather than simply an idea you came up with or an idea or desire that has been imposed on you by someone else. And this, to me, this is kind of, you know, the light bulb. And I think that as parents, again, we struggle with this because sometimes our kids have these moments of, I want to be this, I want to be that. Yes, I'm willing to put in the work. Will you, mom and dad, you know, financially and time-wise support me? And then 6 months later, things get a little challenging and the kid says, I'm ready to quit. And that's when we parents tend to take over and say, wait a minute, you know, I've already invested X number of dollars, X hours of time. You're not quitting. And the passion in the child starts to waver and maybe get blanked out altogether. So this is a huge challenge. And, you know, your take seems to be that if the passion is there, then the effort and the work and the results are going to come, and we parents need to get out of the damn way and let it happen.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be quite that harsh, but I think there's a lot of value in that. Because,
you're nicer than
you know,
I am.
Well, it's true. I mean, we do, and it's more expensive now than when I was growing up to go into something like this, but I think that's the humility on the parent side. I think we have to trust them to fall down and get up, and maybe they, you know, they will blow it. But in my experience, when there's passion, when you're really in line with what's most important to you, and for an athlete, for a child, this is hugely important. And they're forming, they're in formative years. So they're going to change. But for me as a dancer, I never wavered. And I'm guessing you were that way with your tennis and your dance. You seem like that kind of, I mean, some of us are just wired at an early age. We know exactly what we want and we're ready to go through. And the obstacles are huge. That's, I think the reality check with love behind it is important for parents to share with the kids. But it's also to say, this is up to you. You're powerful. I know you can do it. But you got to be sure that's what you really want. And there's no crime in changing your mind. It's just learning to contemplate, to sit down, learning to sit still and be quiet, that's a whole other ball game, which we could get into. The cell phones, the technology stuff is in my mind. Hurtful in a lot of ways, because I would love to see these kids reflect more, spend more time finding out what's really going on inside of them instead of always turning to the tweets and the news feeds to get what they should think and how they should be. So.
That's a pretty powerful statement right there, and we will definitely talk about that.
When my son graduated, he went to Berklee College of Music in Boston. He's a musician. But he said one of his most creative stints was when he had 2 months. He went up to work on some music in Toronto, had no internet, no cell phone. I think he and his partner wrote 50 songs. And he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him, putting all that stuff aside. Now, of course, he uses it. You know, it's part of life. But I think, the piece of contemplation of learning to be still, for not as a punishment, but as a way to learn about yourself and find out what's really important. And that's really important to give them at a young age, the ability to be still and say, what do I really want? Listen to their little voice, you know, that's coming up inside. So.
I mean, you promote in your book journaling as a valuable tool. And one of the exercises that you give, you suggest that the athlete sit silently and ask a series of questions to to himself or herself. And I love these. I just want to read these questions out loud. The first one is, what do I really want? The next one is, what will I have when I achieve this? Then, when do I want it? Then, where do I want it? Then, what behaviors and values will I need to go forward to achieve it? And then, finally, how will having this impact others in my life? And I love this series of questions. And, I mean, this is something that, as adults, you know, we need to do as well. But like you said, I think we're raising this generation that really has lost the ability to turn inward, to ask these questions and honestly answer them without turning to outside social media for validation or confirmation. And so that presents a really unique set of challenges, not just for the athletes, but for the coaches, for the parents, for, you know, people like you who are trying to work with these kids. What do you say about that? I mean, what can we do to help?
Well, I think it's just that, like, encourage discussion to really question. I think we have, well, in this world today, it's kind of sad how we've all made money into God. You know, and we've made being number one the main thing, so that we're in a domination paradigm, as it were. You know, it's all about being the top man on the pole and or the most popular for these kids, or somehow proving their worth through making it to the front page of the sports section, you know, or saying, I'm the one who beat everybody else in the tennis tournament. Aren't I amazing? I think that self-worth comes without any constraints. In other words, the self-worth of a child, of a parent. You know, we do this, we beat ourselves up as parents. We think we're bad parents because our kid didn't win the tennis tournament. What's wrong with this? My kid didn't get the scholarship, but my neighbor's kid did. But the point is that I think we need to go back to understanding that our intrinsic value comes without all the paraphernalia. So the point of that exercise, I guess, is what, you know, how am I going to make my life have meaning? And so they hate sports, but they're doing it because the dad is living vicariously through them, or the mom, or because they want to prove themselves in school. That's gonna be the end is not gonna be so happy for them, because they depend on an outside stimulation for their sense of value. So I know John Mayer, you know John Mayer the musician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he said
absolutely.
He spoke to my son at school, and I thought this was valuable for anybody. He said they're gonna love you. This is your fans. They're gonna love you. They're gonna put you up on a pedestal. They're gonna smash you to the floor and break you and destroy you. He said, but you've always got your music, or you've always got your tennis. You know, you've always got your dance. And if you're passionate about it, it doesn't matter what people say. You do it for the love of it. And I guess I'm gathering Serena Williams and Venus Williams had a love of tennis and have a love of tennis. And maybe that ego that we're seeing, maybe the pride, is just the passion that's coming through,
mm-hmm.
and the sense of accomplishment, which is phenomenal at that level. But underneath that, I would venture to say that there's an authentic love of what they do. I don't know. Wouldn't you agree for some people? Like, yeah.
I mean, you have to hope that that's the case, but again, then you know, like you brought up Andre Agassi, you know, you look at his life and where he is now, and yes, it's awful that his dad put him through what he put him through as a young child, but, you know, one can make the argument that, but for that, would he have this amazing life he has now? And so,
well, yeah, exactly.
You know,
it's
a tough
that.
Call.
Yeah.
Right. It's a tough call. And I think that's where we struggle as parents is finding that balance of, you know, you have the sense that your child has lost the passion for the game, and you push them anyway to continue because, you know, we have the benefit of life experience and understanding that sometimes you have to push through, you know, bad times or negative feelings in order to achieve the good stuff. But
well,
balancing
hang on a
that
second.
With... Okay.
Sorry, I was just going to say, let me just give an example of that. It's not letting them quit. For instance, I worked with a volleyball player who was on the way to a scholarship in college volleyball, but she was really burned out. Her coach was driving her. She had injuries she was dealing with, and we were working on rehab for that using the yoga. But the biggest thing for her wasn't that she wanted to quit. It's just that she was burned out. And I think that's a huge issue at any level in elite sports, is that burnout. So what she ended up doing wasn't quitting her track to the college scholarship. She just took a summer off or maybe longer and did beach volleyball, which had a whole different flavor to it. And I think it built her skills as a volleyball player too, an indoor volleyball player. But it's a way, it's like allowing them to get some breathers in there to balance the life, to go out on a date, you know, to have time to go to church or to have a day where they just lie in the grass and look up at the sky and do nothing. That's the kind of thing that I'm saying. Take a break, you know. There's such a thing as taking a break from all of it. And maybe they need to miss, you know, a month or two of competitive season to get back on track. Maybe that's all they need. But I'm just saying there has to be balance or there's imbalance. And that's dangerous.
Yeah.
That's where the drugs come in. That's where the alcohol starts.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I, you know, I think with tennis, it's tough because tennis is a year-round thing. There is no break. There is no off season. And so it's up
and is
to
that healthy?
The player. Oh, it's horrid. I can tell you, watching my own child, it's totally unhealthy from a physical standpoint, from an emotional standpoint, from a family standpoint. It's incredibly unhealthy, but it's the environment we live in, and just like the social media is the environment.
Yeah, but hang on a second. But you're giving your power away, Lisa. Here's the thing. I'm just going to coach you for a minute. Do you mind?
No,
this is what
we
all,
I need it.
This is what we all do. We say, oh, this is how it is. But we have, I mean, we're powerful. And we can be powerful in a really positive sense. Maybe, you know, if you look at some athletes that, I mean, there's a guy who pitches for the Dodgers now who was a quarterback in high school. You know, maybe there's something to be said for time off or switching sports. You know, maybe we can say no instead of yes. This is, you know, I think it's up to us. It really is. And it's up to the parents and the coaches to help these kids so they don't have multiple surgeries when they're 16. I've seen baseball players have multiple elbow surgeries or a soccer player with a blown out ankle at 17 because no one ever said it's okay to take a break. You know, that you come back stronger when you have a break. We all know that. When the body has a time to heal, to regroup, to get back to equilibrium, you're stronger, you're faster, you're more agile, your mind's more sharp, you know? So I just want to question the whole system. Do you mind?
No, I'm glad you do. And I question it all the time. My point, I guess, is that, you know, our governing body here in the U.S. and the international governing body has created a system that promotes year-round play and has, you know, pushed the message that you can't take time off or you'll fall behind. And so that's why, to me, it's so important to have somebody like you on this show talking about the fact that you don't have to buy into that. And I was guilty of buying into it. My kid was guilty of buying into it. And guess what? My kid just took 3 months off. And and it's not hurt him. And
exactly.
In fact, I think it has been a true gift, not just to him, but to our family. I think we all needed this break. And So I, you know, without going into detail, I do understand the benefit. And I think, you know, getting back to what you do with your yoga and the training that you provide, because I want you to be able to talk more specifically about what you do. You know, those breaks are maybe not the time to start working with somebody like you, but to utilize the tools that you've provided to these kids in a day-to-day existence that doesn't involve or revolve around their sport or their activity.
Well, I think, Lisa, that the reason I suggest learning this before the competitive season is just as you said, there isn't that edge of tension that they're in the pre-competition phase, so that they have a chance to kind of become familiar with some of these techniques and practices. Because once the competitive season is going, I would like them to have the tools under their belt. And, you know, not just for optimizing performance. I mean, one of the things I think that's so valuable about the mental techniques and practices from the science of yoga is that it does optimize performance. It teaches you how to manage yourself in breaks between competition, but also to understand how to manage distractions with advertisers, with coaches, with friends and family, and all the things that can happen around competitive play, or internal distractions, you know, with boyfriends and girlfriends at the team level and all. And with managing a schedule, how to get that in place before you start the season and say, these are the areas that are really important to me. I don't want to let them go, even though I'm on the fast track, or tools to deal with fear, or avoiding injury. And at the high school level, I guess at all levels, but I think at the high school level, the team discord thing, managing the opponent's team, there's a lot of violent talk and there's a lot of deliberate intentions to harm, I think, which is upsetting to me, that goes on in sports now. I think they need to learn how to manage that stuff, and it's best done way before the first problem starts.
Sure. Well, and so, to those of you listening who, when you hear the word yoga, you think, you know, sitting still with, you know, a quiet room and chanting meditative words and focusing on breath, I want to just say that one of the unique things that you offer in your book, Kamala, is a moving meditation. And
yeah.
I love that. That was something new for me, and I'm going to incorporate it into my daily life because I think it's really cool. Can you talk a little bit about that? And for athletes, I mean, we know sitting still and quiet is not really in their DNA, and it's a skill that they have to really work hard to develop, and it's a valuable skill that they should work on developing. But in the meantime, you offer them a way to keep in motion and develop the breath work, the meditative work. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, this is an age-old technique from yoga, but the way it came up was I was working with a 14-year-old baseball player at a training facility in Orange County, California, and he was very nervous and embarrassed, you know, at working with me, an older woman, in the middle of all these elite baseball players, you know, working on their techniques and drills. So being distracted and high energy and also having no self-confidence, we did a moving meditation, which was an adaptation of a longer version of that. But he, I think the fact that he could move and focus his mind and his body all into one concentrated effort. I quoted what his mom emailed me after the first session, said he was hitting him over the fence. Parents were standing there with their mouths open. He was fielding like a butterfly. The ability to focus while in motion is huge for an athlete, and a tennis player's all over the court. So as you said, it's hard for them to sit still. They probably twitch in their sleep. We all did when we were on the elite track of sports. You know, they just never stopped moving. So it was powerful for him, and it's a way to do it in that nobody can tell that you're doing it. So you don't embarrass yourself to your peers if you're on the field before a game, if you're playing baseball or softball or basketball or whatnot. So, and as a tennis player, you know, between matches, you can take a walk and do it. You can practice any of this stuff incognito without all the paraphernalia. In the end, though, it's really important to learn to sit, you know, as an adult for a longer period.
Sure.
But for kids, no. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And
so
I think it's a
really
great
well
introduction. Yeah, I think it's a great introduction to self-reflection, to, you know, understanding what's really going on inside. And, you know, again, it's a way for these kids to do it without sitting on a yoga mat chanting Om, so they can
well,
be in their quote, natural habitat.
Well, and the point is, too, it's really about, yoga is really about getting rid of what you don't need, which is your mind. And I don't mean that in a really negative sense, that we shouldn't think, we have to think, thank God we can think, you know, we want good brains, we want to be sharp and intact for things. But psychologically, for an athlete, thinking has no place, because once you've mastered your drills, and I know coaches are probably can, and you can identify with this, once you've got the drill down, getting out of your own way is the biggest gift you can give yourself. Just let your body play the game, because it knows to react. And so the moving meditation gives a pole for the mind to go up and down on, you know, like a mantra. I think mantra is a word that's used incorrectly in society. A mantra is actually a tool, a word that steadies the mind, that gives the mind something to hold on to, so it doesn't spiral out into emotions and thinking when it's not necessary, you know, when you don't have to drive a car or fix dinner or whatever else you have to do. Sometimes we don't need to be thinking. So, the moving meditation involves the body and the mind and the breath and everything, and it's a good tool. Yeah.
So how much time should a young athlete spend on this inside training?
That's a tough call. I think it's an individual thing. I don't know that the high school age, and I've even worked with college kids who just can't seem to find the time for it, even though they desperately need it. I think if we could start them young, working with someone like myself in a way that it feels more natural to them. And as parents and coaches, I think it would be really helpful if we got them to put away. I know this is a huge thing to ask, but if we could get them to put away the cell phones during certain times, you know, so they don't have to rely on them. I mean, adults rely on them, too. It's become a disease in our society that we can't live without technology, and it's a shame. But if we could help them as younger kids and as parents, this is huge, to learn to trust themselves that they do have the answers inside. If they just take some time to be quiet and sit still, you know, go outside and take a walk, or just learn to value that inward looking, I think that they'll have a leg up on it. But to actually make them do a strenuous discipline with it, I don't know that it would work, you know, in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean,
just
I know there, you know,
gently.
I know there are a lot of coaches out there that, you know, ban cell phones during practices, and certainly they're banned during competition. But the kids seem to find a way to just sneak a peek at their Twitter feed or their Instagram or. Excuse me.
It would be good, though. It would be good if they could learn that, the value of not, I mean, maybe they need to hear it from peers, you know, and that's the best way for them to learn is from each other. But, you know, you could just say, just try this and see how it goes. If you don't do it during practice, if you actually, here's a thing that I mentioned in the book that's really important, is the power of intention. And I wrote this blog for a tennis website recently. The power of intention is really effective when you go to the practice court or you're doing a game. If you learn to set a goal, for a short-term goal for that practice, and maybe your goal is, can I not look at my cell phone for the next hour? And how will that impact my play? Let me just experiment. So the element of curiosity, what would happen if I focused on something other than tweeting how would it be for me to focus on my game, you know, my footwork or my backhand? Or how would it be for me to focus on not getting upset? You know, how would it be for me to focus on my breathing? How would it be for me to focus on, you know, being my best self on the court rather than looking at the phone, you know, as an experiment.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a great point. And again, you know, for teenagers, that's a huge ask. And I think that, you know, the coaches can really create an environment that supports that. It may take a little effort, but I mean, I can't imagine a kid, if a coach said to the kids as they walk out for practice, you know, drop your cell phones here and you can pick them up after the last ball has been picked up. I can't imagine any kid's going to argue with that. They're going to do it. So, you know, they're going to argue with the parents if the parents say leave your cell phone in the car. But I can't imagine they're going to argue with the coach. So maybe this starts with coaches. I don't know. I'm just going to put it out there.
Or just if my bet is there's one kid on the team who's smart enough to understand the value of leaving a cell phone out. I'm just guessing. There's one who's reflective in every bunch, and that's the one who's going to get ahead. The one who says, you know, I met a young football player, and I thought it was wonderful. He did so well in the combines because he worked out in silence. He knew the value of putting everything else aside and focusing on the technique he was using. And for that reason, he stood out, and everyone wondered why. Well, you know, it's because he had the smarts to leave it behind. So there, you know, I think they just have to learn the value. I really think it's like, it's an addiction. And if we can break our addiction slowly, just like we break our addiction for cigarettes or alcohol. I mean, I know it's hard for some people, but, you know, if you can start to introduce the idea that maybe they'd be better players, you know, find out.
Mm-hmm.
Do an experiment for a week. Don't use your cell phone and practice and journal about it. See what happens, you know, or talk about it among yourselves. You know, encourage the coaches need to encourage that behavior. And it's hard for me because I didn't grow up, thank God, in this generation with this technology, you know, and it's everywhere. It's just, it's hard to get away from it. So, yeah, I think as parents, too, example is the very best way to teach your kids. If we're always looking at our cell phones, that's how they grow up thinking they're supposed to do it. I think that's how we set the example. If a coach wants to teach an athlete a certain behavior, they have to do it for a number of weeks, and then they can teach it because then it's authentic, in my opinion.
That's a big statement, and I agree with you. And I love that you come at this from the perspective of being curious. And my favorite yoga instructor here in Atlanta, that's a phrase she uses often in class, you know, be curious. What would happen if you, you know, held this pose for 3 more seconds? Be curious about that, you know. And I love that approach to things, because it's not a judgment. It's not a right versus wrong way of doing things. It's just asking the question and, you know, taking it upon yourself to explore. Maybe that's part of it. Go ahead.
Well, this is the main, one of the great tools of yoga is self-inquiry, self-study. And as an athlete, and even as a parent, I mean, this applies to anybody. If we learn to kind of dissect our behavior and be curious about what happens as a result of thinking a certain way or behaving in a certain way, then we have incredible empowerment because we can make the choice to change directions in the way that we're behaving or the way we're training or the way we're working with our kids, if you're a coach or an athlete or a parent. We have so much power. This is my main message. We are all incredibly powerful, but we have to pay attention to our own selves and stop looking outside for what's right or wrong. And even a young child who's an athlete knows. They have a knowing. I think it's a fallacy to think that we need to explain to them because they do know. I think we all do. And many of us grew up being dominated by, it's just the way our culture was, being told what to do, how to behave, how to think, what you have to do, like you said with the tennis. We have to play year-round because that's what they told us. Well, who's to say that they have it right, you know? Maybe my son or daughter needs to take 3 months off and they're going to beat the hell out of everybody when they come back to the court.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, but they have to understand that. The kids have to understand that too, that they have the power to make choices that are informed. They don't have to just do it because somebody told them to, you know, and neither do we as parents and coaches. And that's and that curiosity is, well, gosh, what would happen if I didn't do it this way, you know, let me find out. And that's yoga.
Well, and yeah, I mean, is the world going to end if I make this change? I think, you
Correct.
Know, putting things in perspective is also an important outcome of all of this, is learning that, you know, just because you don't do it the way everybody else is doing it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the universe is going to explode.
No, I mean, and take for instance, weight training, you know, these women athletes, softball players and soccer players, they don't need to lift weights all the time. It puts so much load on the joints. This is my opinion now. You guys can all hate me for what I'm saying, but think about whether a female body, depending on the sport, needs to be lifting weights at the college level regularly like the men do. I question that, and I've spoken to these athletes, and they say, I can't do this. It's destroying my ability to play the game. So we need to question, and the athletes need to question, and they need to be allowed to question the way they're being trained. This is really important, I think.
I agree with you. Well, we are coming rapidly to the end of our hour, which is crazy to me. This has gone by so fast. And so I don't want to end without giving you the opportunity to talk about where people can find your book and your website and how to contact you and all those things. So plug away.
Okay. And I my intention was not to offend anybody here, and I hope that people will take this all with a grain of salt and question everything I've said today, Lisa. So, but the book is available on Amazon, and my website is KamalaNellen.com, KamalaNellen.com. And if you are a coach or an educator, the book is for the athletes. But that being said, if you are a coach or an educator, if you go to my website and sign up, I would be happy to send you a copy of the book so that you can recommend it to your athletes. And I would love to come back, and I hope I get to meet you in person one day, Lisa. It's really been a pleasure to be with you.
I would love that. Thank you so much. And I will tell the coaches out there, please take advantage of Kamala's offer to get your free copy of the book. It's not a big book. You can read it in, you know, a couple hours. It's got some incredibly valuable information in it that is simple to implement. It's nothing, you know, mind altering in terms of, oh my God, my head's going to explode if I have to read one more thing about being quiet. It's all very doable, and it offers very specific tools to these kids to calm their minds, to focus inward, and to perform better. So please do take advantage. KamalaNellen.com. Is that, again, the website?
That's it. And I would recommend it to coaches and parents, too. So,
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Kamala. I will let you get about your day on the West Coast. It's already halfway over here in Atlanta.
Go to lunch.
It feels like such a Monday, I can't even say, but I'm sure everybody's feeling that after the long weekend. But, again, thank you so much. And you are welcome on the show anytime. So, you know how to reach me, and your publicist knows how to reach me, so please come back on whenever you like. And to my listeners,
thank you for
tuning in today, and have a great week, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.